Chapter 32 The Curious Gods.
Udo, hey, do you hear me? Come back.
You keep calling me that name.
Because it is your name. Where did you go?
I had to think about it before I could answer. Already the memory was fading rapidly.
I was somewhere else.
Yes?
I mean, I was somewhere else entirely. I was someone else.
Oh, do you remember who?
Yeah, it was a strange name. The strangest name I've ever heard. Carl Jung, but...
Oh.
I don't remember much about who I was. I knew so much when I was there. I was some sort of engineer or alchemist or something. I knew the principle of how things worked, knew how to make light without fire, and the rest fades.
What did you see? She asked.
Oh, everything. There was a wagon made of glass, for one. Actually, it reminded me more of Karen's raft. It was all metal on the inside, or if not metal, then some material that was somewhere between metal and wood. And it moved along a fixed track. Faster than anything I could ever imagine.
I closed my eyes to see more, but the memory had faded faster than the dreams that came through a drunken fog. In frustration, I tilted my head back. I don't know why. It felt natural to do. As I reached for an escaping memory, it felt natural to lean back and search upward as if the contents of my mind had leaked away like wisps of smoke. It was a lucky accident. That feeling of leaning back recalled something more.
There was no high country there.
Ah, yes, her voice smiled.
You looked straight up, and all you saw was blue. It was like there was only ocean suspended high overhead, but I'm sure I wasn't looking at water. Even when sighted from high country, water has a movement to it. You see patches where the colors deepen. The blues grow darker where the water is thickest and becomes light in the shallows. This other place, though, the blue was too blue. Directly overhead was the deepest shade, spreading out in a circle. I could see the edges of it. And then to the sides it faded a little, but it was all so even, so uniform, as if it had been painted.
That was all you saw up there?
No, I gasped. The question had recalled more detail. I saw. It was a world. High overhead. A world like Erda, but it wasn't finished. I could see holes in parts of it, framework in some places, like the beams of our half-timber buildings.
Udo?
Something in her voice snapped my attention back to that room. We occupied our usual positions, she on the couch, while I perched in the chair. I shut my mouth, which had been on the verge of running off with the chickens, and nodded that I was ready to listen.
You saw the first world. First worlds, in fact. You saw the world upon which mankind was born, and the first world mankind created.
I don't understand.
That blue vastness overhead? It was the sky. It's what the sky looks like on a natural world, a world the gods did not create.
The gods did not?
Of course, she nodded. If you dig around in there for a few remaining shreds of Carl Jung, or really any of the other team members we have in archives, all that knowledge is there. It's just not near the surface in his case. The things we're discussing right now were considered common, mundane, and boring in his time.
Boring? All the world was canopied by a fucking miracle!
Yes, that's what I'm trying to tell you. Of course it's a miracle for a man of Theodiscus. You knew of no other possibilities until recently. But the people of Carl's world were born there. It was always thus for them. They knew only blue sky since before they were capable of forming lasting memories. As far as they were concerned, that canopy might as well have been solid granite.
What was on the other side of all that blue?
She raised one shoulder, let it drop.
Chaos. The outer chaos.
I had to think about that a moment. She'd spoken quite clearly, but I was still convinced I'd misheard.
The blue sky was a shell? Some sort of shell?
She shook her head. Air. It was just air. The invisible stuff you breathe in and out of your own lungs every moment. Only it's not so invisible, as you must now realize. Stack enough air on top of itself, shine a light through, and it happens to look quite blue.
So then, that world was flat?
She smiled and held her hand out, palm up. Directly above the palm, a sphere slightly larger than her head appeared, rotating lazily. I was mesmerized. I'd never seen her do anything like it before. As I leaned in closer, I realized it was covered in water and patches of land that swirled along the curved surface, like the smeared rainbow trails that stretched along the skin of a pearl. A blanket of white softness floated all around it. Fascinated, I reached out with a finger and dragged a line through it. Swirls erupted over the surface and skittered away slowly. When I examined my fingertip, I discovered it was damp.
Clouds, I muttered.
She agreed. You just stirred things up quite considerably down there.
I knew they were clouds. I rubbed the ball of my thumb against the tip of my forefinger. As far as I could tell, the water was real. When I climbed the mountain at Erda's southern pole, I had to cut through the clouds. I was soaked when I came out the other side.
My voice trailed away as I watched the sphere. The clouds that I'd kicked up seemed not to be calming back down.
What's happening there? I asked.
You disturbed things quite a lot just now. There are natural air currents at play. They tend to follow a predictable pattern. It has to do with a number of things, including the world's position relative to its star, as well as the varying temperatures at play upon its surface. You just cut a line straight through a weather system with your finger and created a, well, essentially a cross-draft. Now there are parts of the sky suddenly cold where they were once warm and vice versa. Air pressures and temperatures are exchanging places rapidly. You see there? Those two swirls of cloud running off in opposite directions? You've never seen their like before, but if they make landfall, they'll sure to ruin a few lives.
This is real? It's not some godly vision?
She wobbled her head side to side. Not quite a no, but certainly not a yes either. It's both real and unreal. We call it a simulation. But you can be sure, for the people going about their daily lives down there right now, it is very real. And it is a very big problem for them.
My stomach sank. Oh, gods, what can I do? Is there anything I can do to stop it?
You could try gathering up the clouds with your hand to stop them. Do you think you could?
I looked at her. Her face was unknowable, like trying to find love in the eyes of a statue.
I swallowed and reached for the fragile little ball, came near to touching, then drew back my hand.
I don't know, I said.
You're sure? Perhaps you'd like to hold the world in your hand? Can you imagine what that must feel like, Udo? To hold an entire world in the palm of your hand?
I don't want it, I murmured.
That ball, that little orb of blue and green and brown and white, it had seemed so majestic before. Now it stared at me like a hateful thing, an accusing eye that did not blink.
I want nothing to do with it, I hissed.
Very well, she said. The world disappeared.
What happened to it? I shouted.
I'd shot straight out of my chair so that my body drifted lazily toward the ceiling. I had to catch myself against it and settle back to the floor. They're gone, she said, as if stating that certain friends had stepped out for the evening.
Where to? I demanded.
Nowhere. They're simply gone.
You unmade them?
I promise you they didn't feel a thing.
But you can't! You can't just—
A single eyebrow lifted. For the first time ever in my dealings with her, I knew true fear. I can't. I made them. I was horrified. Even through the unease I felt in her presence, I could not contain my outrage.
Yes, but surely you can't just unmake them after. There must be some responsibility.
I don't understand, she said maddeningly. A few moments ago, they did not exist at all. I caused them to exist for a little while so that I could show you something. When that was achieved, there was no further need.
The people on that world, did they know?
Know what?
I don't fucking know. Did they think they were real? Did they have lives, histories?
As I said, as far as they were concerned, it was all very real.
Why? Why would you do that? Why even make people at all? I couldn't see any of them.
Why? Well, it wouldn't have been much of a simulation if I hadn't, would it? I drifted slowly down to the bed. It was as close to a collapse as one could come in that place. The strength of my legs had simply given out. I couldn't understand what she was telling me. I couldn't understand the lack of feeling in her. It was as though I didn't know her at all. What mother could be so callous? Even my own mother, who had unburdened herself of me at the first opportunity, had taken care to ensure I had at least some fighting chance to live on. She could have just pitched me onto a midden heap and been done with it. Udo?
My lips were numb, and I had to try more than once to answer her clearly. She didn't say anything when I did, so I looked at her. She was looking around the chamber, eyes squinted in dissatisfaction.
We need a change of scenery, she finally said.
Then she met my gaze.
Don't you think? Penned up in here far too much. We need a new setting.
Where else is there to go? There's the toroid, I suppose.
She scoffed and waved the suggestion away.
I meant some place worth seeing, not an exercise wheel. Here, take my hand.
I did. I stood next to her in a wood at once alien and familiar. Taken as a whole, it was like many others I'd seen in my life. Brown floor blanketed in the wet and slowly softening cast-offs of that which still lived. Green undergrowth hovering just at the knees, held aloft upon stems rooted in the decay of death. The trees stretched high and straight. They would have made excellent building lumber, but in that silent place it would have felt a crime to brandish an axe. But then one noticed that which was different. Strange red berries surrounded by small white flower petals at the tips of each tree branch. The leaves of the ground cover were like nothing I'd ever encountered, soft as the down of some newborn goose. Even the bark which scaled the trees was a new experience, knobby and hard as rock, with red veins shooting deep within the cracks. If I'd had a knife, I would have prized off a chunk to see what was on the other side. I leaned in closer to it and inhaled.
Udo?
Irpisha's voice from somewhere behind me. She sounded confused.
I've not lost my mind, I assured her. This tree is something new. It smells... I'm not sure. Hard to describe. Bitter and waxy. Like ants.
Ants?
Yes. Have you ever disturbed an ant nest? Or happened upon a line of them marching along in the dirt? Maybe up a tree? They carry a smell with them. I'm smelling something very similar on this tree. I don't see any ants, though.
There are none, she said. You're smelling formic acid.
I looked back at her.
Acid?
I knew the word, but, as with many others, did not remember learning it.
You should avoid touching them as a rule, she advised. The bark will not harm the skin, but if you then wipe at your eyes...
Yes, I muttered. My mind was only half with her.
The other half was held in a kind of spellbound shock as details about carboxylic acids drifted to the forefront of my attention. Chemical chains began to unwind inside of me. Methyl formate danced in circles around formamide, methanol and carbon monoxide intermixed within a base of sodium methoxide, then a little ammonia mixed in and hydrolyzed with sulfuric acid. I felt a hand on my shoulder. In a soft voice, she said,
Hey.
I had to steady myself before answering.
Sorry. Yeah?
Be careful with that. There's a lot in there now. It'll be easy to get lost if you try to take it all at once.
I didn't realize I was taking it at all.
She nodded. I've heard it described like a drug. It is possible to become so lost in your mind that you never find your way out again.
This has happened before?
She smiled. Did you think you were the first? Quite a well-defined ceremony, don't you think? For something that had supposedly never been done before? She removed her hand and began walking in what I thought was a random direction.
Hey, is there a point in my future where I'm not taken by surprise at every new revelation? I called.
Careful what you wish for, her voice trailed back to me. The sound was small and fading fast, and I hurried to catch her up. It should have been easy to follow her. We were both clad in fresh melam, so her body was simply a void passing among the trunks. But Irpisha always had a way of not being seen when she felt playful. I stumbled after, feeling oafish and cumbersome in the world's gravity. I was sorely tempted to lean against the trees, but her warnings about the acid put me off. Soon I was panting, just trying to keep up. After a while, I broke through a tree line into a relatively empty field. A few stumps stood proud of the ground cover there, the exposed fibers dry and cracked, long dead. The reactor of that place burned at nominal yield, brightening the day and casting a rich, comforting warmth from pole to pole. When I came out of the trees and its rays bathed me, it felt as if I was blanketed in soft flame. It was good. A soothing heat, like hard spirits in the chest, my skin prickled deliciously under it. In a short while, it would be too hot, and I would begin to sweat. My head would probably burn as well if I let the hood down, but for the moment I did not care. I only stood in the clean, prickling heat of their sun and felt it fire the bones within me. You look like a cat in a window, she laughed.
I agreed. It has been too long. So much time cloistered in that cell, or in the toroid, or wherever else. Up until this moment, the last truly wide-open spaces I'd walked were in hell. I didn't realize how much I missed this. And you're going to take me back there, probably. I just realized...
I will, but your time in that place is essentially finished. The hour of your choosing is now at hand.
Choosing? I thought I'd already been chosen.
No, your choice of worlds.
I looked at her. I had forgotten to feel the sun upon me.
What do you mean?
She nodded in a direction leading away from the forest. In the distance was an abandoned village. All the homes and buildings appeared to have been shuttered, and there were no people out to make the most of the daylight. I hadn't noticed the place before she pointed it out. I'd been too fixated upon the feel of life falling over my body.
What happened here? I asked. They were raided and ran off?
Come with me, Irpisha said.
The melam retracted to her wrist so that when she took my hand, it was with the skin of her own. I'd had my hands exposed since arriving out of habit. Not that it made anything easier to feel. The power of the godskin is such that you do not feel it upon you when worn. It was only that I wished to see my own skin when manipulating the world around me. When she took my hand in hers, I felt new warmth and a softness I'd not realized existed in any reality. It was like being touched with skin that was worn for the first time. The sensation was a symphony within my heart, the soaring triumph of Beethoven's 9th tempered with the pulsing depths of the Requiem Mass, and, hidden within the intersection of these opposing waves, a small and trembling voice sang,
Nella tua fredda stanza, guardi la stella che tremano, de amore e di speranza, ma il mio mistero è chiuso in me.
She led me into the dead village. I was apprehensive at its stillness, which crouched like a denned predator, yet her touch fortified me. Again I wondered if this was how children felt when their mothers kept them. She took me into the main thoroughfare and continued on slowly, stepping easily down an aisle witnessed on either side by sleeping buildings, as if we were to be wed. I saw an old well at the village center that looked as though the last time it had given water was now 3 generations gone. Stupidly, I pointed at this curiosity and said, "A well." It would have been reasonable for her to make sport of such an unnecessary observation, but she only nodded, her smile lazy and content. I commented on her smile. It made me happy. She said, "I am smiling because I'm near the end. I'm near your end." Her words made me uneasy, so I ignored them. Instead, I nodded toward the well again and said, "We never did this in Erda. We knew to make seep wells near slow-moving water and such, but nothing as blatant as this. The people of Ara'a are not put off digging. Things are managed differently here." "Ara'a, that's the name of this world?" She agreed that it was. "It's not a name I've heard before," I said.
"No, it's an old language."
"Did they leave this village because the well dried up?" I dropped a rock over the side and heard a deep splash a moment later.
"They are still here," she whispered.
I turned around to look again at the homes. They appeared to be constructed mostly of mud bricks and dried grasses. Apparently, they avoided using the local trees for their construction. Slowly, I searched each building in turn, staring until my eyes began to dry. "There are no signs of life here," I said. "A village this size should have livestock milling around, penned up in yards, or..."
"Domesticated animals are kept at remove down the road," she said, pointing along the way from which we'd come. "They make too much noise to be kept where the people shelter."
"Is that where they are right now?" I asked. I walked to one of the houses and examined a door, which was actually made of wood, though not taken from the trees we'd seen. It was made from a mat of sticks as thick around as a thumb, bundled together with grasses and stiffened with dried clay. I reached out and scratched at the surface with a fingernail, watched a few flecks of gray dust break off to sprinkle the side of my knuckle. Somewhere inside the house, possibly the other side of the door, I heard the sharp gasp of an indrawn breath and muffled scurrying. I did some scurrying myself, jolting backward several steps until I was well away from the house, and looked around. I saw nothing nearby that would make for a decent weapon, not even a good rock, so I crouched low on the chance I would need to bolt. I glanced at Erpicia, who was still by the well and smiling at me.
"This place is not deserted," I hissed.
"Oh, you don't say," she laughed.
She came to stand beside me. I felt rather foolish maintaining a crouch when she stood next to me like that, so I stood in a way that I hoped demonstrated I was not embarrassed by my own behavior.
"They're in there," I whispered. "I think they're hiding. Have we alarmed them?"
"Oh, probably," she said. "But they weren't hiding in their homes because we arrived. They do this every day."
"What, every day? When do they get out? When do they do their work or their farming?"
"At night, obviously."
"Obviously?"
"Well, Udo, if you couldn't do your work during the day, when else would you do it?"
"Sure, fair point," I nodded.
My attention kept wandering back to that house. Were they looking at us right then? Were their unfriendly eyes upon us? I looked at some of the other houses. Pretty soon, I felt as if there were hidden observers all around, silently plotting.
"Why do they stay in like that?" I asked.
"They believe that terrible monsters will snatch them away in the daytime if they come out."
I looked at her.
"Dvergas, huh?"
She shrugged.
"Oh, whatever you'd like to call them, really. You know as well as I that the Dvergas are simply drones with a pinch of the dramatic blended in. Here, they are referred to as djinn."
"But why make such an edict? What's the point of tormenting them if they leave their homes?"
"Oh, they're not tormented. Any one of them could step outside right now and not a thing would happen. They'd walk outside, probably white as scoured bone and trembling like an old lady, but they'd walk around, maybe throw some dirt up in the air, and then flitter back into one of these houses screaming, and nothing at all would happen. We most likely would not even notice.
All right, I said slowly, but they think they'll be savaged if they step out. Something put that idea in their heads.
Well, we did, of course.
You did? As in the gods?
She nodded and returned to the well, sat down, stretched languorously in the sunlight, and sighed. Not directly, but yes, it was essentially us.
Sometimes a revelation is so horrific that the only sentiment left to a man is to pose the blatantly obvious. That's what I did.
She said, There are a number of reasons, many of which will not matter to you, yet. But the short answer is that we wanted to see what would happen.
I took a few steps away from her and turned a slow circle, taking in all of the buildings of that place.
You can't be serious. This Araa, its population is the same as Erda?
Comparable.
And you mean to tell me that not a single person has challenged this imprisonment?
They're not imprisoned, though, Udo. They're perfectly free to go out at night.
They're not free at all. This is some kind of sick fantasy. Not a single one? Not a single one of these people has decided to put this admonition to the test? I can't believe it. People grow immune to fear after living long enough without the demonstration of fear's necessity. Someone somewhere should have stepped outside. And if they haven't, I have to question whether any of these around us now are even human.
I'd swung my arm over my head in a wild arc and heard the flutter of aggrieved wings somewhere close by.
Such as you've described has happened, she allowed.
And?
And when the problem gets out of hand, the djinn come and take the offenders away. Quite messily, I might add.
I was outraged at how easily she admitted these truths. So then it is real?
Well, I'll say it's real when it needs to be.
Why? I demanded.
Suddenly I was upon her. I hadn't seized her in hand, not yet. I knelt at her feet, trembling hands snatching up handfuls of dirt.
What evil have they committed? What offense have they given?
None. In general, they are fairly decent folk.
Then why?
Irpisha didn't answer at first. She looked at me a moment, smiling. I thought she was getting ready to tell me I should calm down and felt a scream growing within, but that is not what she said. What she said didn't make any sense at all.
We're curious about instinct as a survival mechanism. We've observed it enough in the lesser animal life to understand it plays a vital role, and we know that humans possess it to some small degree. After all, what is it that causes the newborn babe to latch onto its mother's breast and suck? That's nothing you can explain to so new a creature lacking language, just as birds, for example, lack the language necessary to explain structural requirements. Even so, when it's time to make a nest, they make a nest, and it holds up to heavy use, believe me. What causes a bird to build a nest? They are not taught to do it by their parents, all those mommy and daddy birds. They simply know how to do it, and they do it only when it becomes necessary. Neuro-replicative analysis has provided scant understanding of what's at play. We can see the impulse emerge, but do not understand from whence it comes. Hormones, deoxyribonucleic acid, genetic mapping, random chance. We've had our little round and round on these matters. Lalwani's convinced that behavioral patterns emerge through the raw force of numbers. He's very dismissive of such studies. His is always the direct path. Physical adaptations, changes in size variables, immune system enhancements. The will of the creature is ever a tangential curiosity to him, if at all. One of the things he loves to say the most in such conversations is that if you get enough monkeys to throw shit at a wall at the same time, somewhere in all that mess, you'll find the stirrings of Monet. A little reductive to my mind, but then a certain part of me likes to agree he may have a point.
I don't understand a goddamn thing you're telling me right now.
Probably not, she agreed. And I'm about through with telling you that you'll understand eventually, though you will. So here's what I will say. The point of all this is to see if we can breed an aversion to the sun into a human population. We'll let these people live as they are, perhaps another 300 or 400 years. Then we'll harvest their embryonic offspring and seed the new crop into an empty world where no such edict to remain inside during the day exists. They'll be given a fledgling language, a few ground rules to get moving, and, apart from that, very little else. A new primitive society, grown once again from the ashes of some earlier experiment, carried forward, observed, adjusted, all to see if social behaviors can be made genetic through persistence.
I let my mind wander in search of a term I needed. I'm not sure how long I was gone. Time moved strangely for me since the merge, but Irpisha was evidently synchronized to the same clock, and so made little comment. When I'd come back to myself, I had the phrase I sought, as well as the realization that the sun had dimmed noticeably. After I recovered from my disorientation, I said, "I think you're speaking of behavioral genomics." She scoffed.
"Outdated alchemy. Your ancestors had an amazing gift for insight, but the tools they crafted for investigation always lacked a certain style. We're doing something far more profound than fiddling with bee colonies here."
Again, my eyes were drawn to the homes of mud bricks and dried grasses. I tried to imagine what a people so contained must look like, and could conceive only of heartbroken, miserable beings. To be denied your own son. "This treatment doesn't seem monstrous?"
"No. But don't hold that against me," she said. "If it makes you feel better, I understand very well why it would seem monstrous to you."
"You do this out of what? Boredom?" I was feeling combative.
"No, not at all. We do it because humanity may one day have to survive in a place where hiding away from the sun is essential, and we must know if such a thing is feasible in the long term before committing."
"And you've shown this to me, why?"
"You're going to be a god, Udo. It is time for you to pick a world. Araa is one of which you may choose."